This is a Building Bridges, your community and labor report special. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
To find out a great deal more about what has been happening in Haiti and what the plight and conditions of workers have been in Haiti.
And we have Chris Floyd, who's a journalist, and we have Charles Arthur, the director of the Haiti Support Campaign, both based in London.
Chris Floyd is an American journalist and columnist with the Moscow Times and Counterpunch. And Chris, why don't we begin just by setting a little bit of the pace for us about the economic circumstances that precipitated the recent coup in Haiti?
Right. You know, for about 100 years now, U.S. policy toward Haiti has can be summed up in about two words: cheap labor. And that's what it's all about. That's what it's always been about, not democracy or fighting communism or humanitarian intervention. It's about preservation of cheap labor for heavily subsidized American corporations. Sweatshop diplomacy. And what we've had here is, of course, this has gone on since the first United States occupation of Haiti back in 1919 to 1934, when we rewrote their constitution to allow foreign ownership of land and businesses, and also established the army and the National Guard, the Haitian army, that every subsequent dictator has used as an instrument of the most vicious repression imaginable. Now, all of this was accelerated in the 1980s under Reagan and Bush administrations with their so-called market reforms, which is the privatization of everything that hadn't already been sold off to foreign masters and local bagmen. And I think one example that's often used is what happened with Haitian rice. Rice is a good example. These reforms forced Haiti to open its markets up to highly subsidized American rice, and the native rice market collapsed under these cheap imports. Thousands had to leave their self-sustaining farms and join people looking for work in the city. And this is a pool of dirt cheap labor for American corporations. And then once the native market collapsed, the American companies raised their prices, which result was even more poverty, spreading throughout the society, more desperation, more instability, falling life expectancies, and even cheaper labor. Well, what's interesting related to the 2004 is that one of the point men of this Reagan-Bush market reform drive was a man named Andy Apaid. He's actually an American citizen, and he was chosen by the Reagan administration to head up a sort of a sweatshop consortium of U.S. and Haitian factories subsidized by massive tax breaks and government grants and credits. And all of this is under the Duvalier dictatorship. And at the same time, Reagan and Bush are bolstering the Haitian military. Now, so that's happened in the mid-'80s. Now, in this latest coup, you know, who do we see at the head of one of the so-called political opposition groups? And it's Andy Apaid, which is very curious in itself because he's an American citizen, and Haitian law doesn't allow for dual citizenship, but he's playing a key role in installing the new government. Now, one of the things that sparked off this new so-called uprising was Aristide's plan to raise the minimum wage in Haiti to the princely sum of $2 a day. This was something that Apaid and his industrialists and their cohorts in the United States, you know, they just couldn't stand for that. This is like one of the straws that broke their camel's back. You know, so they really upped the wattage on their long-term opposition to Aristide, this hamstringing of, you know, any effective government in Haiti. And they were bankrolling this by the U.S. agency, National Endowment for Democracy, a sort of quasi-governmental agency that our government has used for many years to subvert foreign governments and skew their electoral processes to get results that are favorable to Washington. So you have all this going on. I mean, this is part of the economic background. I mean, very simplified, but it's really part of a pattern of you know, 80 or 90 years of this sort of thing to preserve Haiti as a reservoir of cheap labor for American corporations. And incidentally, we have now the new government in Haiti, or the new forming government, you know, is talking about reinstituting the army that Aristide disbanded. Well, this is another bonanza, because you're going to have to equip that army and uniforms for that army. You're going to have to arm that army. Well, who's going to do that? Well, the American military and the American military-industrial complex, you know, arms manufacturers and things like this. So, you know, here's another good economic boon from this sort of sweatshop diplomacy. But I think that's part of what's going on.
And to talk about a sweatshop and how this actually plays out on the ground, we have Charles Arthur, the director of the Haiti Support Committee in London, who broke a story on the suppression of an organizing drive in a sweatshop in Haiti just recently by the rebel forces. Charles, do you want to tell us about that?
Our British Solidarity Group has been working quite closely
with a workers' organization in Haiti called Bataille Ouvrière, which means workers' fight in Creole. And since the mid-1990s, this organization has been trying to help Haitian workers to organize unions and really cut its teeth in the assembly plants or sweatshops in and around Port-au-Prince, where textiles or clothes were being assembled for North American companies, and one of the main clients at that time was the Walt Disney Company. We've been following them and trying to support them and promoting their campaigns and trying to lobby in Britain and Europe and North America with people who are buying the products that are made by these workers and trying to use consumer pressure to support workers and their unions who are attempting to organize for better paying conditions. One of the things that we've been working on very recently is a new free trade zone, which was set up on the border with the Dominican Republic near a town called Guanamanth. This was a massive free trade zone that was opened in middle of last year, which was owned by a Dominican company called Grupo M, which is the biggest textile assembly company in the Dominican Republic. So it's Grupo M has leased this site from Haiti. And it's set up the first factory there, which is supplying, it's assembling Levi jeans for the Levi Strauss company. It has about 600 workers in the first factory. On February the 10th, these workers formed a union in order to try to push their demands for better pay and conditions. On February the 10th, they registered with the Haitian authorities as an official union. We heard that on March the 1st, not coincidentally, the day after the Aristide government was overthrown in the latest coup, we heard that the entire union membership of 34 members had been sacked, had been fired, had been dismissed by Grupo M. The next day, March the 2nd, the remaining workers arrived at the plant in order to go on strike, to protest against this union busting. What happened was that they were met by a contingent of this so-called rebel force, the former FRAP and the former FARD soldiers who have mobilized in the month of February to overthrow the Aristide presidency. They called them in, and this gang of armed thugs beat up the workers, aggressed them, handcuffed many of them, and forced the workers to go back to work. It is an absolutely outrageous violation of all internationally recognized labor standards, which allow workers to form unions and to assemble and to organize themselves and collectively bargain with the management. So we're in the process of trying to rectify this by putting pressure on both Grupo M, its main contractor, Levi Strauss, and also the World Bank, which has lent Grupo M $20 million in order to help them finance this free trade zone. As I speak now, those workers are still being sacked. The union is still broken, but we're campaigning in tandem with Bataille Ouvrière to try to get this decision overturned and to get those workers reinstated and the union recognized.
Now, the rebel group that came in, were they contacted by the management of the firm? And also, I think there was a report that the Dominican Army also intervened.
I haven't heard about the Dominican Army intervening, but I have heard that, according to the rebels or the irregulars or whatever you want to call them, who did come to the factory and who did attack the workers, they said that they had been called specifically the night before by the Grupo M management, who said they needed assistance because workers were going to cause trouble the next day.
Well, I guess one of the things we should also look at is the question of the whole free trade zone in Haiti. And I think both of you can certainly comment on that. And I know that Bataille Ouvrière is also rather critical of the conditions of workers under the Aristide administration as well. And Charles Arthur, can you address that? And certainly also Chris Floyd, if you can give some of your concerns, because you had also indicated in an article that you had written recently that the efforts of the Aristide government, on the other hand, to raise the minimum wage was a kind of catalyst in some ways also to the various forces deciding that Mr. Aristide had to go. So why don't we go to start with Charles Arthur, the director of the Haiti Support Committee. What was it like under the Aristide administration in terms of workers' rights?
Yeah, I'm very pleased to be able to talk about this because from my understanding and from working quite closely with organized workers in Haiti, I have to take a very different view of this one that is put forward, that the Aristide government was a friend of the workers, and that is one of the reasons why it's overthrown. I don't disagree that those who are coming to power now and those who are benefiting from the removal of Aristide are, in fact, the most reactionary elements of the Haitian business sector. But I must take issue with this proposal that Aristide's government was a friend of the workers. There have been very many labor disputes and many attempts to form progressive, combative, and independent unions in Haiti in the years since May 2000, when the Family Lavalas government came into being. And we have seen on many, many occasions that from the very top of the government right down to the local government, the efforts of the Family Lavalas party, the Family Lavalas government, have been to break any independent unions. This is one of the most dramatic cases of this was the strike at the Guasimal orange plantation, which supplied orange peel for the Cointreau liqueur. 2 years ago, they had a rally at the plantation, which was attacked by local Lavalas family elected officials and hired thugs, and two of those union members were killed. The union was broken by this vicious attack, which was led directly and specifically and unequivocally by local Lavalas family officials. And as a result of the attack, the Lavalas ministers went on the air and described it as a legitimate attack against terrorists who were attempting to occupy land, and that the position of the Lavalas government was that they would defend property. As to the minimum wage, it has to be pointed out that the minimum wage was 36 gourds a day since 1995. As I said, the Lavalas family came into the government in May 2000, and they didn't increase the minimum wage until July 2003, over 3 years later. What did they increase it to? Not to what the union sector who took part in the discussions proposed, a modest 100 gourds a day. No, they only increased it to 70 gourds a day, which is a derisory figure, given taking into account the currency depreciation and the massive inflation. 70 gourds a day now only represents something like $1.6 a day. So I must take exception to this depiction, which I think is quite erroneous, of Aristide's government being a friend of the workers. It certainly was not. And ask any organized workers group in Haiti, and they will tell you the same story.
Well, Chris Floyd, what is an administration to do? You address the issue of the strangulation economically of Haiti. We certainly saw that with Michael Manley in Jamaica. We've seen the onslaught of World Bank and International Monetary Fund policies around the world that strangle and constrict the economies, making even progressive leaders virtual captives. So maybe you can tell us a little bit more about that in juxtaposition or as part of some of the things really that Charles Arthur was saying.
Well, that's true. I mean, he's very right about setting up some sort of dichotomy as Aristide's regime is angelic and demonic opponents coming out, although I think the opponents are demonic themselves in a certain way. In fact, this is probably, and I don't know if Charles would agree with this or not, but this is probably Aristide's greatest failing, is this the fact that he took on board all these market reforms, and I think part of it is that this was part of the deal for putting him back in power. I believe he was actually involved with it before, but part of the deal was that Clinton wanted him to institute market reforms when he came back in power. That was part of the deal for them for the American occupation in 1994, I think. But yes, this is one of Aristide's great failings, has been to sort of take on board all these things. It's almost as if one reason he's been kicked out is he just wasn't a good enough servant of these sweatshop diplomatists. And so I think we've seen he's sort of fallen between two stools, as the Russians say. He lost support of working people. He lost support of honest unions, as Charles was talking about. And, of course, he was not sufficiently subservient enough to these other interests. And so I don't know what lesson we should draw from that, really.
If I could come in now, I agree with what Chris is saying. If Aristide had been able to build on his obvious constituency, which was the peasants, the informal sector, and the workers, it would have been very much more difficult for the reactionary forces to overthrow him in the coup. And it was, in fact, very sad to see that by the end of February, Aristide almost had to rely almost exclusively for support on armed gangs from the slums and ghettos, and the Steele Foundation, former CIA and Special Forces security guards. And this was a sad commentary on Aristide's inability to build the popular movement. In fact, quite the reverse happened. It suffered and deteriorated under his presidency. But I think what we have to focus on now is what something that Chris was talking about earlier, is that this seemingly inexorable move towards making Haiti into one giant sweatshop. Aristide, as I said earlier, authorized this Group OM run free trade zone in 1 month, and his administration also passed legislation for 2 other new free trade zones, one in near City Soleil in the capital, Port-au-Prince, and the other just across the bay of Port-au-Prince in a place called Lafitte. So it's quite possible that the whole free trade zone concept of the economy is going to mushroom in Haiti, especially now that we see these people such as André Appède, Charles-Henri Baker, Hans Tippenhauer, Maurice Lafortune, all these businessmen with interests in the assembly sector, playing a very, very significant and powerful and influential role in this transition government. And it was certainly interesting in this respect to see the first 2 things that the new prime minister, who was nominated just a couple of days ago, his first 2 comments were firstly to say he thought that one of his priorities must be to compensate the private sector for the losses that they'd experienced during the looting and rioting at the end of February and the beginning of March. And the second comment that he made in public was that he would commission a committee to consider whether it was right to rebuild the Haitian army. And I think the events in Wanamance at the Group OM factory, sadly and very frighteningly, almost is a snapshot of what we can expect in Haiti in the months and years to come. And that is a very aggressive and assertive business sector with a focus on assembly production, exploiting the workforce and absolutely squeezing and strangulating the workforce in order to squeeze as much profit out of them, and rebuilding the Haitian army in order to make sure that the workers are unable to protest, unable to resist this crass and grotesque exploitation. So I hate to be so pessimistic, but I think we're facing a very, very bleak future in Haiti at the moment.
I was going to say, I absolutely agree. I mean, that's why I was a bit at a loss of the question of what to do about it. I really don't know what to do, because I think we're seeing this, as I say, this template that has been going on for practically 100 years now. Also, Charles' description of what's going on reminds me, it's also a pattern we see the Bush people use in Iraq. It's you destroy some place and you come in and reconstruct it, and just sort of compensating these people for destroying what your own thugs have destroyed, you see. So it's just really a shell game of shifting money around that way. And but I think what's also important is that what is so bad is that someone like Aristide, Aristide as a symbol, however imperfect he was as an actual leader, but just as a symbol, could not be allowed to stand. There's just no alternative going to be allowed to stand to this sort of crony capitalism. It's just not going to be. We talked about what Aristide could have done, but had Aristide even tried to do these things, which he should have done, he would have probably been out much faster than that, because the opposition was funded, as I say, by the United States government. It would have been, I think he would have been out even quicker than that, because I just don't think they're going to stand for anyone to stand for an example of an alternative to their way of doing business, and that means, Even if, like Aristide, or someone like Aristide, more effective, who is a capitalist, a democrat, he's a capitalist, but they also adopt what the Vatican used to call the preferential option for the poor, means using the power and resources of government not just to facilitate private profit, but also to address social needs like education and housing, fair wages and medical care, pensions, protection from exploitation, all this sort of thing, clean environment. This is the sort of example that can't be left to stand in Haiti or in the Caribbean, because it might spread, across all through Latin America, where American corporations have enjoyed cheap labor and big profits. And I think also it couldn't be allowed. They're afraid that this example would spread to Mississippi and Pennsylvania and Michigan and Oregon and Texas and California. You see, I mean, it's just So I agree with Charles. I'm very sort of, I have a very bleak outlook for the future of this sort of thing. And but it's a template that we see in Haiti, and it's a template that they would really like to impose to one degree or another throughout the world, I think. This is part of, this is our part of our the imperial dream of these people that are now in power in Washington. And they're enforcing this. Wherever they can enforce it, they are enforcing it with and backing up with military power.
Do you know of any role that U.S. funds have been playing, had played in the National Endowment for Democracy? We've been hearing reports about U.S. funds flowing into Haiti to cause this coup and to fund.
Well, we know that the National Endowment for Democracy has been supporting the opposition. They supported the opposition during the first presidential campaign involving Aristide, and they sort of backed this, I forget his name is Marc Bazin, I think, a former World Bank official who ran against Aristide the first time, and they were bankrolling his opposition in supporting the National Endowment for Democracy and other things like that.
Charles Arthur?
Yeah, on the National Endowment for Democracy, it's pretty clear that this organization was channeling money to this International Republican Institute, which has played a very, very important role both in creating this coalition of political parties, the Democratic Convergence, and almost certainly in bringing about the appearance of this group of 184, so-called civil society coalition, which is led by the business sector. That is pretty clear, although it seems to me that for some strange reason the exact figures about the amount of money that they've spent and what exactly it was spent on remain a mystery, and I would have hope that U.S. taxpayers would try to make some investigation about where that money has gone and why and what it's been used for. The other, of course, unknown U.S. intervention is the so-called rebels and who was backing them, who was funding them, who was arming them, and how was it that they were able to move so freely back and forth across the Dominican Republic border. I think this is a story which the details of which will probably only come out, sadly, in the years to come. Going back to the unions, it's the AFL-CIO did help build up these docile unions in the late 1980s, and we still have those unions around in Haiti who believe really that the best way forward is to cooperate with the government of the day and to cooperate with the employers rather than build up a rank and file who force those other players to treat with them, to deal with them with respect and dignity. But I want to refer to what we can do, and the Haiti Support Group in Britain is very clear about this, that one of the things that we can do and the practical, concrete steps that we can take are to provide active and strong solidarity with combative unions, and particularly this Bataille Ouvrière Workers' Federation. It has 14 unions grouped in the 1st of May Bataille Ouvrière Union Federation, and it's doing excellent work, really absolutely necessary work of organizing workers into new unions. And we should really, I think, focus on them because there are the real need for some leadership in the progressive sector to try to revitalize the popular movement, and Bataille Ouvrière are really standing out as a beacon, really, in Haiti in this very dark time. So, specifically, there is an email campaign going on now where people can send an e-letter, to Levi Strauss and to Group OM demanding that they reinstate these sacked union people and demanding that they recognize the union. And something that we're doing here in Britain, we're trying to make a connection between progressive unions in Britain and trying to get them to twin with counterparts in Haiti in the Bataille Ouvrière Union Federation so that this kind of solidarity can work both ways and that people in Britain can learn about organizing and the struggles of workers in Haiti and vice versa. And we see this as a very important thing to do to internationalize the connections between progressive sectors. And I think this would be very good if it occurred in the United States. I know that there is a Bataille Ouvrière support network in New York, and I would encourage people, listeners, to try to get in touch with that organization and see what kind of things they're up to and how they can contribute to the to the success of the Bataille Ouvrier movement in Haiti.
Well, Charles Arthur, director of the Haiti Support Committee in Great Britain, we thank you very much for being with us. And the website that you can get more information about Bataille Ouvrier and the other activities, some of which Charles have referred to, is www.haiti.support.gn at apc.org. That's www.haiti.support.gn. .gn.apc.org. And Chris Floyd, an American journalist and columnist with the Moscow Times and Counterpunch, you can get an article on Haiti, such as we've been speaking about this morning, if you go to the Counterpunch website. So again, Chris Floyd and Charles Arthur, thank you both for being with us.
This has been a Building Bridges, your community and labor report special.